Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, a scholar discusses the Turkish election. We get an update on the war on deadly Ebola.
I don't know if it's a win and lose situation. We're trying to keep up.
We look at the suggestion that Russia might be testing steps to cut the nation off from internet. And a nasty rumor about a pair of superstar singers. It's right here on The Voice of America. Results are in from Turkey's election, and my colleague Victor Beatty is following all that. Victor, what do you have?
Well, Susan, Turkey's ruling Justice and Development Party won Sunday's snap parliamentary election just 5 months after losing its majority status in a June 7 poll. It's a boost for President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The AKP, as it's called, captured about 50% of the vote, more than 300 of parliament's 550 seats. Analysts say it appears many voters turned away from nationalist and Kurdish parties following an uptick in violence, including twin suicide bombings in Ankara last month that killed more than 130 people. Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal, speaking with me, agrees.
Everybody was expecting some sort of a hung parliament the way it was earlier. But I think two important things happened which led to this result. One of those was that some of the violence that took place actually scared many of the people who had gone on to the Nationalist Party to come back to the AKP. And the second thing that happened was there was a conscious realization that you have to have a powerful government, a more secure, stable government, which can last there for 5 years to be able to take care of some of the new issues that have started to develop. One of those, of course, is the Kurdish issue. Then is the issue of the Islamic State. Third is the issue of the refugees. And all these things put together, the people clearly understood that there was a need for single party, sort of a stable government that can last for 5 years. So I think it's not a bad decision, it's not a bad outcome either. And it could very well be a positive development which may actually allow greater degree of flexibility than was possible earlier.
What will this do for Turkey's secularist past?
The secular past is an interesting issue. Secular past was as artificial, as you may call, the movement lurched towards religiosity now. The fact of the matter is it's the same people. Their trend and tendencies in their attitude towards the government or to governance itself is very much a function of which side of the bread is buttered for them. They're very realistic, they're very pragmatic people. And therefore, I don't see that this leads to shifting away from secularism. What I see is that it tends to reflect a degree of ratcheting effect on the movement in one or the other direction. So it could very well be that with increasing closer relationship with the European Union, this kind of a development and evolution would in fact maybe a good thing in the future.
What about the Kurdish insurgency? What impact might it have on that?
That's a very difficult question because, you see, we now have in the region contradictory objectives. Every country seems to have contradictory objectives. So much so, as Henry Kissinger said, here is a situation where enemy of your enemy is not your friend. In fact, he's your enemy too. So we have a problem on our hands. Here is a situation where the Kurdish problem is not a unique problem anymore. What Kurds do for their own sake tends to create problems for the region and for Turkey. And if Turkey is in difficulties, it will not necessarily support the allies on the Islamic State. So if you look at it that way, then there is a problem. Because originally the expectation was that IS will take care of the Kurds and therefore the Turks will be able to play sort of a moderating role. That didn't happen. And now we have a problem on our hands where Syria is falling apart, where the Russians have come into the picture, other countries are now involved, and there is a clear-cut delineation, a clear-cut division between what you could call a Shia constituency supported by Russia and a Sunni constituency supported by Saudis and the Turks and tacitly supported by the Americans. So now the scene has changed. The structure of relationships and alliances has changed. under these circumstances, you really cannot think in the old terms as we were thinking in the past, even 6 months ago, where the issue was relationship with Kurds and working out a peaceful settlement with Kurds. Not anymore. It really is now an issue of how do you solve the entire Middle East problem, in which Kurdish problem is just one particular part of it.
Iqbal says the election might also improve Turkey's cooperation with the European Union in helping to stem the flow of refugees and migrants fleeing the Syrian conflict and heading to Europe.
Thank you, Victor.
All right, Susan.
Time for a look at what's going on the web today, and joining me with the details is social media reporter Olin Akisholu. Welcome, Olin.
Hi, Susan. Well, there's certainly a lot of talk on social media about yesterday's parliamentary elections in Turkey. One of the top trending hashtags worldwide this morning on Twitter was Bu Seçimin Sonucu. That translates to election results, or literally final results of the election. It's already been used more than 25,000 times today. This isn't a very big surprise because the Turkish population is pretty active on social media, and routinely we'll actually see hashtags related to Turkish politics start trending worldwide. A lot of photos getting shared of groups gathered at political rallies, especially the ruling AKP party. There's a mixed response on social media, with some people happy the AKP regained its majority, but also plenty of people unhappy with the results. So really a lot of what we saw heading into the election.
What about the HDP party? They retained seats in parliament.
Yeah, well, there's also a lot of talk about the HDP party. Kurds have shown an increased presence on social media, especially recently. And the HDP's leader, Selahattin Demirtas, has 1.4 million followers on his personal Twitter account. And that's actually more than a lot of U.S. politicians. His tweets after the election results promising to continue fighting for peace in Turkey got thousands of favorites and retweets.
Well, what else is going on?
So something else a little bit more fun that started trending is Movember. Since the month of November has now officially started, it's time for Men's Health Awareness Month. A lot of men take part in this annual tradition by growing out their facial hair for 30 days, sharing pictures on social media.
Okay, well, thanks, Olin.
You bet, Susan.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A group of Canadian researchers have developed a quick and inexpensive way to test for hepatitis B and male infertility. They say that their new paper-based DNA test could especially be helpful in diagnosing these unrelated but serious conditions in developing nations. Writing in the Journal of the American Chemical Society, the researchers say that within 10 minutes, their new test can detect an early-stage hepatitis B infection in a patient's blood serum. This is something that would give medical professionals valuable time to develop a proper treatment plan before the infection can spread. The same test can also be used to predict male fertility by checking the DNA integrity of sperm as precisely as current proven testing methods. The researchers say that their new diagnostic test can be made from materials that cost less than $1 per device. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The World Health Organization reports 3 new confirmed cases of the disease Ebola in Guinea in the week ending October 18th. The WHO says since the beginning of the current Ebola outbreak, there have been a total of 28,476 reported cases in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, with 11,298 reported deaths to that date. Dr. John Dye is the chief of the United States Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases Viral Immunology Branch, and he's been involved in the development of Phyovirus vaccines and therapeutics. And he joins us now on the line. Welcome, doctor.
How are you?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
Excellent.
Say, first of all, can you give us an update on the war against Ebola? Are you winning?
I don't know if it's a win and lose situation. We're trying to keep up. With this current outbreak in Western Africa, in 2 of the countries, they haven't had a reported case in at least a month, so that's a great sign. There are still cases in Guinea, and we're still battling, let's just put it that way.
Well, how are you approaching your research? What are you looking into?
So I work at the United States Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, which is USAMRID, and that's a mouthful, I know. And for the last several decades, and myself for the last decade, we've been looking at developing vaccines and treatments for Ebola virus and other pathogens of interest that could potentially cause pandemics. So in the past 10 years, we've developed multiple vaccines that we have taken through small animal models and moved them into monkeys, seen protection, and now some of those vaccines that we've been developing at USAMRIID and testing are actually being assessed in Western Africa. So there are multiple vaccines that are currently in West Africa being implemented by Merck and Janssen to see if there is any efficacy. On top of that, we've also been trying to develop therapeutics, monoclonal antibodies, and drugs to actually combat the virus, which are currently being investigated as well. So there's a lot going on right now with the therapeutic and vaccine front with Ebola.
So for the layman, does that mean we're pretty close maybe to finding something to help here?
I think we are close. I think we have things in our cabinet that could be effective. The thing about this outbreak is, as you just mentioned, the number of people that were infected and the number of people that succumbed to the disease. Ebola has been around since it's been around long before 1976, but we first learned about it in 1976. And prior to this outbreak of Ebola, there's only been about 20 outbreaks that have occurred. And we're talking about a total of 3,000 to 5,000 people that have been infected. So we haven't had a lot of people to look at to see if vaccines or treatments actually would be efficacious. So a silver lining, if you want to look at it that way, from this outbreak is we have a lot of people to look at. We have a large number of people that were infected and survived. So we actually have a way of trying to assess whether these vaccines or therapeutics work.
Well, thank you very much, Doctor, for taking your time to speak with us today. I appreciate it, and good luck with your work.
Thank you very much, ma'am.
Dr. John Dye is featured in the National Geographic show Breakthrough, which premiered on Sunday, November the 1st, and will be running for several weeks. Coming up on International Edition, what is Russia up to concerning the internet? And the rumor mill once again causing trouble in the music world. Russian authorities are reportedly testing measures that they say will protect Russia's internet from foreign interference. But some worry the efforts are really aimed at finding ways to cut that nation off from the web during times of political crisis. My colleague and social media expert, Doug Bernard, has joined me, and he's been following this story and He's written an article about it on our internet website, if you want to go see it. It's called Russia Possibly Testing Internet Kill Switch. And Doug, what can you tell us about this?
This, I think, is a story of a case of a public official maybe saying something to the media that he regretted later. Last week, the head of the Russian telecommunications ministry, a man named Nikolai Nikiforov, basically told Russian media that Russia was concerned that Western nations, who may be hostile to Russia's interests, may try to cut Russia off from the internet, and that Russia, much of the internet traffic in and around Russia is actually flows through hubs in Europe. So he basically said that he was ordering telecommunications and ISPs, internet service providers, to begin experimenting with various means of how Russia might, in effect, cut itself off from the internet, the global internet, but still keep its national intranet running.
Oh, kind of like an office building here.
That's exactly right.
How would this all work?
Well, that's the serious question, and that's why they were beginning testing. Now, Mr. Nikiforov came out and was talking about various means they could use without getting too technical, techniques such as maybe deep packet inspection, some other means of sort of, you know, limiting or cutting off international web traffic. But in the end, Mr. Nikiforov and the state telecommunications head basically came out and said, no, we're actually not trying this. This was a rumor. We're not thinking about this at all. I think what may have really happened, and some of the analysts that we spoke with, is that, yes, in fact, they've been testing this maybe for a while now. And what they're finding is it's very difficult to simply cut an entire nation the size of Russia off from the global internet. So now that it looks like they can't do it, sounds like they're trying to back off and say, well, that was never our intention anyway.
Well, the thing about all this is, say they were able to cut themselves off,
mm-hmm.
you cut yourself off from people coming through the internet into your country,
sure.
But you also prevent people from inside the country reaching out to the outside world.
Exactly. You may remember some years ago when Egypt was in the early stages of a political crisis there in the early days of the Arab Spring, and Egyptian authorities did exactly that. They kind of employed this trick to essentially erase Egypt from the internet. And they thought, well, this way we'll kind of tamp down the protests and social media outrage. What they found is that one action crippled their economy and their ability for anybody in that nation to get anything done. So clearly, I think it's just not a winning strategy, unless you're a nation like North Korea, to think that you can just cut yourself off from the global internet and keep everything functioning within your country.
But a small country might be able to do something like this.
Well, small countries possibly, because small countries have fewer access points in and out. So, for example, you look at a country like North Korea. There's a sizable population there, but there's only one access hub, in effect, where global internet traffic can go in and come out. And, of course, the North Korean officials control that hub, so they monitor everything that's coming in and out. But a nation like Russia or Egypt or for heaven's sakes, China or these other places, there's so much traffic coming in from so many places that you really just can't catch it all.
Well, thank you, Doug.
You bet.
This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondence, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
A new book about hip-hop mogul Jay-Z and his wife Beyoncé, Becoming Beyoncé, The Untold Story, has been fueling the rumor mill with details of an alleged romance between J.C. and singer Rihanna. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee about how the rumor got started and some of its consequences.
So this gentleman by the name of Jonathan Hay was hired by the producer of Rihanna's first single, Pawn the Replay, to do some work, some promotion work, essentially. And so after this book was released, and inside the book there was some speculation, or it implied that this rumor was made up by a publicist, this gentleman comes forward and says, well, actually, yeah, that's true. I made it up hoping that it would generate some publicity for the song. I just kind of threw it out there to see whether or not it would stick. And by golly, it stuck, so much so that Beyoncé and Jay-Z, and we did not know this at the time, but separated for a year back in 2005, as a result of this allegation.
Now, we should say that Rihanna's representatives, her legal team, and Veda Nobles, who wrote the Pawn the Replay, mm-hmm. said, I didn't hire this guy. He wasn't a publicist. He presented himself to me as something, but they're saying, Rihanna's people are saying, this guy was not officially representing her at all.
No, apparently the producer and the publicist had a couple of conversations, and sometimes this happens in the music industry. You meet someone at a party, they say, hey, I can help you. You say, okay, sure, let me know what you can do. And then they go do things to sort of prove that they have the juice, if you will, to make things happen. And so it sounds to me like that's what this is. And what makes the story even more interesting is that this guy now has an artist and he's promoting a couple of his own songs, which he's hoping to have released on Jay-Z's Tidal platform. So this is going to be really complicated for him if Jay-Z and or Beyonce decide to comment on this or decide to do something about it, which they have not.
Okay, now, still speaking of Jay-Z and Rihanna, Rihanna is reported to have inked a $25 million deal with Samsung, and Jay-Z is involved in that, too, is he not?
Right. Now, we may remember that Jay-Z had a huge deal with Samsung to release his Holy Grail album, Magna Carta Holy Grail album, via their platform. Well, it sounds like, and we don't have all of the details now, but it sounds like Rihanna is going to do something very similar, because Samsung has a new platform that's, I guess, kind of trying to compete with Apple Music, and it's called Milk Music, actually, and it's a radio service. So what I think may be happening here is Rihanna may have agreed to allow Samsung to release this new album that we've been waiting for forever and ever and ever, called Anti. And it would be a great thing for Samsung, because again, it's a highly anticipated album. And she wants to do something interesting for the release. So this would be it, I think.
All right. If you have any comments, you can send a tweet to Shauna at VOA Lady DJ. You can also log on to our website, voanews.com.
We'd like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IEE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On November 8th, the citizens of Burma will go to the polls. Over 6,000 candidates are vying for 1,171 parliamentary seats. It is the greatest test yet of the reforms launched by President Thein Sein and the ruling regime 4 years ago. Election campaigning began on September 8th, and for the first time in memory, no one knows who will win. That's a far cry from the last openly contested general election in 1990, when the opposition National League for Democracy won by a landslide, but the results were never recognized by the sitting government. Nonetheless, problems remain. First, in the words of Assistant Secretary for East Asian and Pacific Affairs Daniel Russell, we all recognize that the political playing field in Burma is not yet an even one. A number of obstacles are built into the system, preventing a truly democratic process. For example, the Burmese constitution reserves 25% of parliamentary seats and key cabinet posts for the military. Constitutional restrictions prevent the most prominent opposition politician, Aung San Suu Kyi, from running for president. And legislative restrictions and discrimination prevent some minority ethnic or religious groups from participating as candidates or voters. During a recent visit to Burma, Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes also raised concerns about religion being used as a tool of division during the election period. He noted to the press in Rangoon, "We see a risk of religious expression being inconsistent with a constitution that separates religion and politics. And of course, when that happens, ultimately it can pose a danger to religious minorities." These elections will be vitally important for the U.S. relationship with Burma. The conduct and results of these elections will fundamentally shape our engagement with the Burmese government in 2016 and beyond, said Assistant Secretary Russell. Our ability to assist the new Burmese government, let alone to look at relaxation of sanctions, will depend on our assessment of the integrity of the overall process. So far, the government of Burma has made a strong effort to improve the administration and transparency of the electoral process. To reinforce this effort, the United States is providing more than $18 million in assistance to conduct the elections. The 2015 elections are an important milestone in Burma's political transition away from dictatorship. But what will be even more critical is that the next government solidifies the political and social gains made and continues to push for additional reform, said Assistant Secretary Russell. The government and people of Burma have an opportunity in this election to demonstrate their commitment to building democratic institutions and processes. If the elections are credible, they can make a significant step forward.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.